So, email from Sandy. We just wanted to you to know we are alive and well, running through airports, eating pasta and drinking wine every day. Well, most days. Thinking of you as we enjoy all the Roman sights. If we're forced to go into our church, we search for some remnant of paganism, offering Dionysus. Kind of fun, actually. Lots of pictures to go through when I return. Say hi to everybody in Saturday class, and we'll see you next Thursday. Take care, as we will too. On to Pompeii on Monday morning to the Villa of Mysteries. So, life's tough in here. Traveling in Italy.
To the Villa of Mystery. Well, that's kind of
thinking. That's, yeah. This is that very picture. And this is my favorite picture of that whole series, too. They're looking in darkness. Bruce is visiting. That's John. You know everybody else? Kate? Okay. Well, let's start. Quick review. Last time we started looking at the projections in science, I find for myself this chapter speaks directly, but I realize not everyone is grappling with these scientific questions. So I just really want to make sure that we look at this material in a way you can get a personal feeling for. So I went through it and tried to come up with why care what projections are made in science. And I mentioned that one of the basic ideas is that scientific work starts with an image. And we think, oh, it's rational. But in fact, it's if you look at the dreams of scientists as they're working, you can see that what they get is ideas appears first as images. So that opens up the door to seeing that even a scientist can interpret their work like we interpret an artist's work, a picture, because in fact it really does begin in the image, just like art. A couple other things that we'll be looking at, how there's a parallel development between developments in physics and developments in psychology. In other words, we'll look at today, for example, causality. If you look at Freud, it's all based on causality. And Jung doesn't dispute that, but he looks to quantum mechanics, which sees besides causality, there's this uncaused movement within the electron. So he wants to say people are more like electrons than bowling balls, and we have to also ask about non-caused movements in our life. So that's an example. That might be a little closer to your own experience if you've been working on your own psyche. Another thing which we'll look at today is that if we look at science as based on an image, that gives us the capacity to make a feeling evaluation for what we're doing. So these are just some places where I've tried to connect with it personally. If you're not interested in science, you might think, well, what is your profession? What is your métier? And are there images below it that, just like we're looking below what we normally think is not subjective, say law, for example, are there images moving that as well? So that's a little bit of background. And then we started with the sphere as an archetypal image that underlies science, and that's where we stopped. And then we'll pick up with the scintillae on page 61. So what she's doing now is going through major images that have been the foundation of scientific concepts. For a couple of purposes, and we'll have to try to always keep in mind, I think, what she's doing, to show how what was once considered an immutable scientific theory in light of later evidence, is seen to be false. So if it's false, then what were we seeing in the old theory? Well, what we were seeing in the old theory was a projection. It wasn't true. And there's kind of a subtext here. What is often projected are images that we now know are images of the self. So you could say, by looking at the shifts in scientific thinking, we're also looking at how we have projected the self into science. And by doing this, for our purposes, we get another look at what is the nature of self-symbolism. And then we could also extend that, which she doesn't do too much, is look at what's driving science. It's actually a projection of the self. So that's where we stop with the sphere. Remember Kepler, that the world is a sphere, and in the center is a point, and then that point is surrounded by a periphery, I guess you'd say, and that point in the center is God. So he's thinking both mythologically and scientifically at the same time. The fact that the sphere expands out from the center means that the outer circle of the sphere is Christ. And the relationship, the parallel relationship between the spherical point of no extension and an extended sphere is the Holy Spirit. So you got mythological thinking, scientific thinking. It's one of the last places you'll see that in science, where the two exist side by side. We've thrown out all the mythological, recognizing all the mythological symbolism, and she's trying to bring it back in. So, Scintillae, page 61. I tried to find a picture of this, and I couldn't find any in any of the alchemical books. In the alchemical mind, there were little specks of light in the material world. So when they were cooking the material, they were trying to gather all those specks of light into one spot inside the material. And when that happened, they thought, ah, that's when you get the gold. Another place, scintillae just means, I think it's Latin for spark, S-C-I-N-T-I-L-L-A-E, the plural. Scintilla is the singular. Other place where you find this idea that there are little specks of fire or light in the material world is the Gnosticism. Remember, the Gnostic myth is that when God created the world, God gets stuck in the world, and there are many different varieties of how that can play itself out. Sometimes it's Sophia. Sometimes it's angels, sometimes it's God, sometimes it's a lesser God. But the common denominator is often that these pieces of divinity are little specks of light. Where do you see that in dreams? Primarily, I think, in dreams of stars. I have seen dreams that the earth is glowing with little specks, but not very often. And what those scintillae represent are the intelligence within the collective unconscious. So if you're lost and you don't know what you're doing in life, you could very well dream of stars, or you could dream of these specks and so that the earth is shimmering, indicating that you're going to start getting guidance from the dreams to help you move forward in life. So that's the scintillae. They are little points. And her point is that this is the archetype behind the point in mathematical abstractions and calculations. For example, the atom was at one time thought to be a point. But remember that you all got the video that I sent concerning the electrons that split. I sent one to everybody.
There's three.
Yeah. Well. Right after the last class.
Our class, though.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was like the difference between the when you perceive the way versus.
Yeah.
He called it the two-slit
experience
in the email 2 weeks ago.
I'm trying to think if I could get it out and show it to you on my laptop. let me see if I can.
I must have gotten it.
Yeah. You probably forgot. Well, it was a really cute cartoon of what we were trying to describe up here, the two-slit experiment. And it was animated, and it showed the particles being shot out of a particle gun. I mean, it doesn't exist, but however they do that in physics, where they can shoot single electrons out of something like a TV. You know, that's what a TV is. It's shooting electrons up to that screen. That's why you see an image. And if they shoot it through two slits, it forms one pattern. If they look at it, it forms another pattern. But the point I wanted to make here is how they're forced to say that electron is two places at the same time. So, see, the point no longer holds. An atom isn't a point. An atom is more like a fog. So, again, there's this idea that there is such a thing as a point in space, and that point would be these subatomic particles, but we know those subatomic particles don't behave like particles. They behave like fogs. So that the idea of a point, which was held through Newtonian physics, isn't valid anymore when you look at quantum physics. So she says, what was projected? And her point is, what was projected was the scintilla, that the science carried the projection of this image within ourselves, and it worked for a while for the purposes of calculation in Newtonian physics, but it no longer holds in quantum physics. So that's the way she's working. Does that sound familiar and make sense? So the next point is on 62.4. And she goes back to the theory of four elements, earth, air, fire, and water. We know now that that is absurd, yet originally that idea was thought to be fact, and it, again, was a projection of the quaternary aspect of the psyche, the four functions, and often the self images show up in crosses, images of four. And I don't know if it would help you to think this way, but just as we think, well, that's a stupid idea, that there are four elements, as it becomes clear that particles aren't particles, we'll someday sit around and say, wasn't that a stupid idea, that there was such a thing as particles? And that is what she's trying to drive at, that our knowledge at the moment is taken as fact, but when it's contradicted, you always can see that it was based on an inner image seen outwardly. In other words, a projection. Causality, bottom of 62. In Newton's physics, you think of a billiard ball, or think of a pool game, or two bowling balls. The basic model is one object hits another and causes that object to move. And that has dominated physics thinking since the 18th century. And we know that particles inside an atom don't operate that way. So you get one ball, and you whack it with your pool cue, and it hits another ball, if you know how much that weighs and how fast it's going, and you know how much that weighs, you can predict how fast it's going to go. And so event one causes event two. But if you look at an atom, that's the nucleus, and you have an electron going around, going around, and you zap it, not the pool cue, but a little piece of light comes in, that electron may go here, or it may go here, if we have a third orbit, it may go here directly, or it may go here, then here, and here. You cannot predict the effect of that cause in the movement of the electron. So the quantum physicists say the movement of subatomic particles cannot be determined causally. Causality breaks down. Then she looks at all the people who put forth and supported this idea of causality, and it was based on the idea that God makes things happen. Again, a theological idea translated into a physical theory. Now, that idea of God is breaking down. And so is that idea of physical causality.
You know, technically speaking, though, it's not the cause that's in question, it's more the effect. It's actually the effect that's breaking down.
Causality. You know, that one thing causes another.
Yeah, but I mean, just technically speaking, it's the effect of what happens when something.
It's actually the determined effect.
Yeah.
It's determinative causality
that's
called into question. So we're left with chance as a physical, as a property of physical nature. But we don't have a God of chance. We have a God of law. Anyone know where we do have a God of chance?
Gambling.
Well, yeah.
Gambling.
And what's the mythological background of that? I don't know of any Western image of chance and divinity. If there is, it's not a big one. You've got the fates, but even they control things. You see, it's always control in the West. Well, Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says, I am the game of dice. So you see, there you've got a shift in God image. Now, remember the stages of withdrawal and projection? She doesn't make a whole lot of that as we go along, but I think here's a point we could, that the last stages of withdrawal and projection is a feeling evaluation. And so I think we could look at, in particular, that God of determinative causality and say, let's evaluate that. Look at the implications of going through life thinking one thing causes another. Can you think of some?
You mean where we do that?
Where we do that, which we now can see as a projection of an understanding, but it's an error that is destructive.
Well, I mean, just the whole idea of God, you know, if you do good, then
absolutely.
So you never then have to think for your own life.
Right, absolutely. I think one of the biggest implications is it throws in the question, prayer. If I say this, that will cause God to do that. If I behave in a certain way, it will have this effect. Because I was treated this way in childhood, that explains my behavior. But look how strongly that idea of cause and effect is rooted in the way we think about things, rather than there is a probability that I have acted this way, and this is the choice I made within that range of probabilities. So what we've got in the atom is the probability of movement. So we're trying to see how our view of physical life and how our view of emotional life are related and based on projections. And as we withdraw projections from one side, it will affect the way we look at the other, and we're given a chance to evaluate our previous way of looking at things. Is this making any sense, Bruce? Okay. Yeah.
I'm thinking of the Grail Legend, that game of chess that they play.
Good point.
And I'm thinking, because up until then it had been, first of all, I thought, I guess along the lines of causality.
Yeah.
And then after that, he was open to love, true love to come into his life.
Mm-hmm.
On the right track.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of that, but these dreams of playing cards or chess often come about when the individual, when we're ready to start recognizing there are non-cause aspects to life to which we have to form a relation, and that then breaks up this mania for control that we base our whole life on. I mean, just look at the way we treat the earth. We have an idea, we cause it to happen. I saw a show on the Bengali tiger on the PBS, and in Bengal, apparently, it's one of the last places the tiger is alive and well. Every once in a while, it eats somebody. And so they were interviewing a farmer whose neighbor had been killed by a tiger. And they said, "Aren't you upset?" He said, "No." "What? Your neighbor got eaten by a tiger and you're not upset?" He says, "It's the nature of tigers to eat people." Mm-hmm. See, the non-control aspect that is so different from the way we look at things. Now, don't particularly look forward to getting eaten by a tiger, but I think we can say, at what point should we have less of a control attitude toward things and more an attitude of what is the meaning of what happened versus how can I control what happened? So that's trying to bring it down to a practical level.
Well, and that reminds me of that whole thing too. Of revenge. The story of a child getting eaten in a zoo by an alligator because his parents had, it was an accident. I mean, if the child, I guess, fell down into it. But they wanted revenge on the alligator.
Right.
And after it all happened, said and done, they killed the alligator. And okay.
Yeah. That's perfect. That's a perfect example. Yeah.
So it's kind of like that control, and it seems like it heads you towards revenge.
Yeah, it really does.
Because you want to find a cause.
You need to find a cause, and you need to
write
the cause, yes. Yeah, and what's the one religion that doesn't proselytize?
Buddhism.
See, because they causality is not central to their worldview. So I think that is a terribly rich shift. And what it means for us in our analytic work is that we are open to events, and when something happens, is that a car screech or somebody screeching?
I like a car screech.
We are open to, let's say, weird things happening in our life. and then ask ourselves, what is it asking of me versus how am I going to control it?
It reminds me of that book, I don't know if anybody's read it, but Life of Pi came out a couple of 2 years, and then the Bengal tiger, and then it ended up this little boy, and he was on the, they had a shipwreck, and there was all the zoo on this, to make it short, the zoo animals also perished, but the little boy and this Bengal tiger somehow survived, and they were on these two different rafts. And just connected by a rope. Anyway, the little boy was terribly frightened, but he kept feeding. He found food for the tiger and satisfied his hunger. So that somehow they ended up surviving, getting back to India. And, yeah. I think it was India when they got back to, yeah. And the tiger went and ran into the woods and somehow they developed a relationship, so the tiger didn't eat him. I just thought about that question.
Well, you used a word which is really important, which is relationship.
Yeah.
That non-causal thinking keeps the door open to relationship, and causal thinking often kills it. Yeah, it's power. I think it's power versus eros. Do you want to maybe, is this be a good point to talk about complexity?
Sure. I got interested in a while back in complexity theory, and I don't know very much about it, so I'm going to try and talk a little bit about a little 6-hour Great Courses thing that I watched in about 5 minutes. And the Great Courses thing is years of work down into a very minimal starting point. But basically, there's a new theory of complexity in science that came out. It started in about the 1961, and it became a theory that was recognized in about the 1980s. So it's very new. And what it talks about is it links things as different as physics and the social sciences like economics and weather and all kinds of things. And complexity theory says that if you have a system where the parts interact with one another and adapt, they act differently than a cause and effect model. So, let's see. So a complex theory consists of interdependent, diverse entities who adapt to their local and global environments. It's not in equilibrium, nor is it chaotic. So if you think about the world economy where different businesses or countries react to one another, that would be a complex system. Or your car, if something breaks, nothing else can adapt. Does that make sense? Weather is a complex system, economies are a complex system, and electrons are complex systems because they actually adapt to one another. They don't, it's not a cause and effect model. So in a cause and effect model, you get...
Do you want to put it up?
Yeah.
Here's an eraser.
You get standard distribution curves, the standard bell curves that you've seen. In a complex system, you will get long-tail distribution curves. So when you get a long-tail distribution curve, as things start adapting to one another in these long-tail distribution curves, you get all kinds of interesting phenomena. And let's see. There are one of the things. Basically, what you get is, as you look at mathematical models, which I cannot tell you how the mathematical models work. I don't understand them. But as you get mathematical models, instead of, you get the long tail distribution, and then you get effects like what they call the sand pile effect, where if you drop grains of rice in a pile, at some point you know that a whole group of things will slide off. You can predict that that will happen, but you can't predict when, which direction, or how much. That is all kind of by chance. But so you can make a prediction that things are going to be, that things are going to happen, but you can't make a direct prediction. So you have probability instead of causality. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's really key, I think.
Yeah, I think it is. And the way this kind of started was when computers first started, there was a meteorologist who was looking at weather patterns, and he had come up with this rather complex theory. And his computer crashed, as they did back then, and he lost all his data. So he restarted, but instead of typing in this really long sequence, he just rounded it off to like the hundredth or thousandth place on one number that was really long, and he got a whole different set of things. So what he realized was in complexity theory, as they looked at this over the next 20 years or so between the 60s and the 80s, something as minuscule as a butterfly wing flapping, in theory, that didn't happen, but in theory, something as minuscule as that could change the outcome in a different direction
of the weather.
So that was called the butterfly effect. And they've done things on different slime molds where they will start growing and changing and adapting to each other, and they will actually be able to move. There just are all kinds of experiments. But the things that I thought were interesting for our work was, for one thing, it's based on a quaternity model. The two, or the four things are, the four variables are diversity, connection, interdependence, and adaption. And if you thought of those as four dials, if you dialed up diversity, different things happen in the systems. If you increase the number of connections, another set of things happen. Interdependence, so you can make, with these four variables and changing them slightly, you can make all kinds of different phenomena.
So it's diversity,
connection, interdependence, and adaption. So they're mathematically unpredictable outcomes. He talked about, you know, there's only one way to be linear. Causality only causes one thing, but when you look at the nonlinear effects, you can be nonlinear in any number of ways. So it just increases things a lot of directions. And it talks about how nature is one of these systems that over time, you know, you get all of these different things. You know, you get rabbits and you get anteaters and you get people and you get consciousness and you get all this different stuff. And that it's just thousands of random things generating that all of a sudden something will really change things. And you can't predict when, but you know that it does. And like in economies, it can change things for the better or for the worse, like that sand pile theory. As world economies started adjusting to each other, or even people in the U.S. buying bigger and bigger houses, the housing market crash was a sand pile theory effect. All of a sudden, it all just crashed because we kept throwing one more and one more and one more bad mortgage on the market until it all crashed. It gets into emergent phenomenon, which is the concept of all of a sudden things will start acting differently, and it just takes one change in things for things to really get much better or get much worse. It was really fascinating, but the other thing that made me think of the God image is this guy is so excited about teaching this. On this little video, he's like, the reason, I'll put a couple of quotes. We study complex systems due to the mystery. He was talking about, you know, there's a lot of practical reasons, but the reason most complex theorists are in that field is they just find it fascinating because it's mysterious. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the way he talks about it, it's obvious that it's a projection, you know, he's so into it. And we should not try to control complex systems. History is littered with examples of people who have tried and failed. Neither can we just sit idly by. We need to seek understanding.
That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. I don't explain it very well because I don't understand it very well, but I just find it fascinating that this is the newest thing in science, and it's based on mathematical models of probability rather than causality.
Very helpful. If I try to sum it up, I would say something like, cause and effect, it's like, assumes one dead object hits another dead object. But with complexity, there are no dead objects. And so electron, I mean, it's dead, but it's got its own probability of movement. So one event hits another probability of movement, and there. Then that probability of movement hits another probability of movement so that the outcome can be so diverse. Mm-hmm. And I love that you can see how this shift is. You can't control it. Mm-hmm. You have to understand it.
And it's coming from scientists who are not looking at this as a God image at all. They're looking at it as we're understanding science more. And but yet it fits so perfectly into what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And it came from them without any of, you know, any thought of this being a change in the God image or projection of the self or any of those things. Just wanting.
And you can see how it affects the way we relate to the world. Tremendous difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's as if the feminine is coming in. Absolutely.
Those
four elements, diversity, connection, interdependence, and adoption are all those feminine values. I mean, it's not control. It's not
and you
get this and that. It's not. It's just. It's all.
And you know, part of the thing with economics and stuff is you have to have an organization, and within your organization, you have to relate to each other. You have to adapt to each other. You have to be able to learn. You can't just I, as a manager, are going to tell you what to do and you're going to do it, because it doesn't work that way, because you, as our world gets more and more interdependent, the ability to adapt faster is what's going to keep you vibrant. And if you have a very top-down structure in your business, you do not have the ability to adapt. So it just changes tons and tons of dynamics. It's really fascinating, the difference of how you look at the world.
It kind of turns ideas of scale on their head, too. I mean, the sense that something slight can have enormous effects. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's an event that seems catastrophic, a system can absorb that without being destroyed.
Right.
You know, we think, well, if something big is going to have big consequences, that's not necessarily the case. The system can absorb it.
Right. That was one of the examples he gave, was the earthquake out in California. The California economy didn't collapse. It does create a robustness in the system. But yet, then there are other places where, if you look at the internet, you know, if Gary's website gets deleted, it only affects a few of us, but if Google gets deleted, then it affects tons of people. So it causes areas where, you know, natural, just by chance, things don't have a big effect, but you can actually try and take something out of a system that is on this long tail distribution and can actually break this quite a bit. So all of those things. I mean, there's just tons of different ways that it adapts and creates robustness in some areas and problems in others.
That's an important thing.
It is interesting, though, that on the one hand you've got these kind of rich, connected things of diversity, connection, interdependence, and adaption, but then the thing underlying how they interact in a way is this mathematical model of probability. So it's like spirit. I'm still kind of torn with struck by that you know, this fact in math is kind of like almost the underlying spirit of it in a way or something. It's interesting.
We'll get to that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and in some ways, the mathematical model came about, but like this guy says that did this great courses thing. He uses stories and images to explain the mathematical model. So it did start with mathematical models, but then they're showing how the stories and images make it something that people can understand, and I thought that was interesting too.
When did y'all like get started?
The butterfly effect was the first thing, and that was the case where his computer crashed, and his meteorological new theory of how you could predict the weather. They realized that just a tiny change in the initial conditions can make a huge change, and that was in 1961.
Okay.
61. So is that the year young?
Done. Yeah. Carrying on Jung's work, just doesn't know it.
And then as they looked at that, then the theories of, looking at systems and how they interact and how the models and the game theories and all those kind of different things came about the next 20 years. And the people that were working on this initially were kind of ostracized by the scientific community, and now they've been embraced that it's one of the most important things of how we can look at building more robustness into our systems and protecting them from problems.
I'm thinking of that and the Black Swan, that book by that economist that came out, and they're both, in a way, making more of a point that, or maybe we're becoming more comfortable with the fact that there's things we can't know and we have to accept that versus thinking, that we can predict what's going to happen in the market and all this. You know what I mean?
Okay.
And black swans are a piece of complexity theory. I don't understand how that, but it is something that was mentioned in that.
Oh, okay. That's a long history.
Can you recount it?
Well, I think it started out, this is just one take of it I got, but so it started out, I guess, in Europe, there were only white swans, and so forever people thought there were only white swans, and then someone went to Australia, they have like a black swan winery and black swan wine, so, and they saw a black swan, and so in like popper in science and different science, it's been taken in that this whole idea that there's a limit to what you can draw from your observations. If all you saw were white swans,
I see.
You could infer there's only white swans.
Right.
It only takes one black swan. So there's a limit to what you can draw from what you can observe.
I see.
And so this economist then, for him, so much of the way we approach investing in all this is that, it's built on what he based his on is that if something unpredictable happens, he invested so that if something unpredictable happens, he would like profit from it versus other people basing theirs on just what they think they can predict. So he's basing his whole approach to, I don't know what can happen, and so I have to invest with that in mind. So it's a whole radical different idea.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, but it's similar in the sense of becoming comfortable
with,
gosh, we can't really know very much.
Yeah.
And the black swan argument is part of complexity theory. Mm-hmm. So complexity theory kind of underlines these changes in how we're looking at economics
mm-hmm.
and ecology and all kinds of different theories. It's an underlying theory mm-hmm. to all the social sciences, and now they're thinking physics as well because of the electrons. So it's the underlying theory that connects them all together, which I think is fascinating as well. But there is an underlying theory.
I just think of foreign policy. Mm-hmm. Look, two wars. Who defeated us? Little people in Vietnam. Remember that? I don't know if you remember that picture of LBJ holding whatever it is, an M14. And then there's a little Vietnamese guy with a rifle right between mm-hmm. his gun sight and his eye with a gun pointed at him. Mm-hmm. And we're getting, we have these, what do we spend for a soldier to outfit him? Force and power. And these little guys are blowing us to pieces with small IEDs. So it's really amazing how relevant this is. And I think it spreads over many areas. I think that was very helpful. Very clear. Thank you.
It doesn't seem, it's very hard to be clear. I have
I thought you did looked
at this so many times, and I thought, how am I going to say this in a few? I appreciate more what Gary does with these books than each week. This takes forever to try and clarify this in my mind so I can say something about it.
Oh, he probably wants to be part of the discussion.
Yeah.
That would be the archetype of
well,
of complexity.
Yeah. I mean, I just wonder, you know, I want to read that one book on bees. But I just wonder how that would relate to that, because it, apparently, you know, if we lose the bees on this plant, we would lose our source of food.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem mm-hmm. to be very adaptable, you know, the mm-hmm. But apparently something's squelching their adaptabilities. I just wonder how that would...
Well, and they've looked at bees, like, and how they adapt to changes in how they gather pollen is one of, like, FedEx and some of the places where how they do the hub and spokes, different things to deliver packages. A lot of that is based on observations of bees.
Oh,
and
really? Because they're real air dependent.
Uh-huh.
They're real what dependent?
I'm sorry, air dependent.
Air dependent, yeah.
And, mm-hmm. and you know, yeah. They all serve the queen.
Uh-huh.
They can break down package delivery so they can mm-hmm. speed it up is based on how bees deliver pollen.
Yeah, I was just wondering mm-hmm. about the only right turn is
the one to take care of.
That's how UPS in a big city will do it. They never make a left turn. Where they're going. And they get there faster.
I didn't know that. Well, that would be an example, too.
But yes, yeah. They do make studies of the fastest way to mm-hmm. make sense. A lot of it is really counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, isn't it?
Well, let's take a second. Look what we've done. I think this is a great spot to go back to the basics. We've looked at the sphere. We've looked at, let's say, the particle. We've looked at four, and now we're looking at causality. And we can see how, in each of those cases, that image gave rise to a worldview which has been superseded. And so that's what she's driving at. And so that the previous worldview was a projection. But remember the... I can't remember the exact... is it the fourth step where the projection has to be evaluated by the feeling function? When we talked about the particle, when we talked about the sphere, there was no real strong feeling reaction to that. When we talked about the particle, also not. When we talked about the four, but as soon as we get to this, look at how we are realizing how destructive the old worldview was, or how inadequate the old worldview was, and the problems that causality has caused us, and the shift to realizing that chance and meaning and probability are also means of linking events. There you can see how the feeling function has come in and made an evaluation. So that in every withdrawal of a projection, every time you see a previous worldview has been superseded, the feeling function then has an opportunity to say, well, let's evaluate that previous system, that previous way of looking at things. And in the first three, it wasn't so important. Here it is really important because I think of the power that causality has over the way we look at things. So that's... and again, the point is that the old causal model was based on an image of God who causes things to happen. And that is now called into question. And remember, just an aside, the big debate between Einstein and Niels Bohr. You know, Einstein couldn't accept quantum mechanics. And his comment to Bohr was, God does not play dice. Yeah. And Pauli thought that showed that Einstein could not make the shift into recognizing the previous error of causality. But all of these then based on a previous image, which forms a certain way of looking at things. So that's 63. Another one, which is, I think, also very important, is complementarity. That's on 64. The image behind complementarity is the taigetsu, that little yin-yang, what I would call the yin-yang diagram, in which there's a black speck inside the light, and then there's a light speck inside the black. And in physics, complementarity would be the expression of that archetype of the yin-yang. And complementarity is simply saying, in that little video I sent you guys, an electron can be a particle and a wave. Which is it? It is both. This is the new thing. Just like causality is breaking down, so is either or thinking. What does that have to do in psychology is that we're always looking what's the conscious point of view and what's the unconscious point of view, and they are both valid. So that life is stereo. We've been taught to think life is mono, but really it's stereo. And that means, too, we have to extend that thinking to many different realms where when we hear a contradiction, we immediately think the statement is false. But it could be that the contradiction is the truth, and what we have to do is learn to live with both and. So there, we have not yet superseded that worldview, but she's pointing out how that worldview is based on an image.
We haven't superseded the worldview
of complementarity. Yeah, both and. It's like that's our new challenge, to live through both and. Maybe someday we will get to the point and say, well, those people who thought both and, boy, were they dumb. We'll see it's a projection, but for the moment we're contained in that image. Some of these we can supersede, some of these we're living out. Some of these when we supersede them we have to give a very strong evaluation to. Others we're not in a position to because we're still, that point of view is our challenge.
I wonder how that relates to the water barrier, Aquarius, and being the container rather than the being contained.
Yeah, because you're contained in, you could say you're contained in mono, but as soon as you get to stereo, you have to contain both sides. I think you, yeah.
I was going to say, we're going from Pisces to Aquarius.
Yeah.
So Pisces, you know, that old stereotype, the fish doesn't know it's in water.
Right.
So Aquarius is carrying water.
Right.
I think I mean, I'm just trying to make it.
With you might say with complementarity, you give up security.
Being a container, the Aquarius,
right,
is akin to complementarity.
I think so.
Okay.
With non-complementarity, one is certain. This is right and this is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
With complementarity, something can be both right and wrong. And then you have to hold that tension. Where if it's only one thing, you can live within that singularity.
Okay. So being the container like Aquarius, as Aquarius is, means holding those contradictions.
It means either and or.
Mm-hmm.
Both and. And I think once you, I mean, this is, I think, is particularly relevant to morality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I talked, well, I was talking to that North Carolina group, which is very Christian. Oh, Jung had an affair. Oh, my God. You know, Jung was an adulterer. Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. And how could he do that? How could he be conscious and not work that out inside himself? And I had to say, and if he hadn't, we wouldn't have Jungian psychology. She helped him give birth to what we now call Jungian psychology. It was wrong from one point of view because it caused pain, but it was right from another point of view. It's what his creative process needed to fulfill his life. So that living in moral ambiguity, which is not the same as living irresponsibly, is a complementary way of living. I have to make some mistakes to have certain successes. I have to accrue a certain amount of guilt to achieve what I'm going to achieve. That's a real place for it. And how many?
And to me, that whole thing is what Jung did: that staying both in his relationship with his wife,
yeah,
being truthful to her,
mm-hmm,
about it, and not hiding it,
right,
and being in relationship with Tony Wolf. That is holding relatedness as a higher value than,
right,
than power or PPFF, or, you
know, mm-hmm,
holding your persona higher than your, or keeping your persona a higher value than relating. I mean, to me, that was his key. He did both. He maintained both relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And that is far more ultimately moral than going around and doing it behind somebody's back, or, you know,
mm-hmm,
and trying to make it work. I mean, that was the really, talk about tough.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see how then you're not contained anymore.
Right.
Another one I also get, you know, the Swiss were between two Nazi countries in World War II. And, you know, how do you figure trains got between Germany and Italy? Well, right through Switzerland. And all that money from the Nazis was stored in Swiss banks. And they took a lot of criticism from it. And I was happy to read Churchill wrote his foreign secretary that though he wished Switzerland had given the Allies more economic advantage, knowing there was one free country in the world kept Churchill going.
See? Mm-hmm.
Same kind of moral ambiguity. What he said, what else were they supposed to do to survive? So when you run into these kinds of situations, then, which I think is a huge shift in consciousness, And it really, it begins the capacity to give. Because if you're going to create something, you're probably going to make mistakes. You're probably going to hurt people. Certainly try to mitigate it. But this the yin-yang-ing, I think that's why it's so important. It's probably time, important to take a break.